Chapter 9. After 2 weeks of nearly constant work, Ed Frank Custom Jewelry had produced its first finished batch. There the pieces lay, on 2 boards covered with black velvet, all of which went into a square wicker basket of Japanese origin. And Ed McCarthy and Frank Frink had made business cards. They had used an art gum eraser carved out to form their name. They printed in red from this, and then completed the cards with a children's toy rotary printing set. The effect, they had used a high-quality Christmas card-colored heavy paper, was striking. In every aspect of their work, they had been professional. Surveying their jewelry, cards, and display, they could see no indication of the amateur. Why should there be? Frank Frink thought, we're both pros. Not in jewelry making, but in shop work in general. The display boards held a good variety. Cuff bracelets made of brass, copper, bronze, and even hot-forged black iron. Pendants, mostly of brass, with a little silver ornamentation. Earrings of silver, pins of silver or brass. The silver had cost them a good deal. Even silver solder had set them back. They had bought a few semi-precious stones, too, for mounting in the pins. Baroque pearls, spinels, jade, slivers of fire opal. And if things went well, they would try gold and possibly 5 or 6 point diamonds. It was gold that would make them a real profit. They had already begun searching into sources of scrap gold, melted down antique pieces of no artistic value, much cheaper to buy than new gold. But even so, an enormous expense was involved. And yet, one gold pin sold would bring more than 40 brass pins. They could get almost any price on the retail market for a really well-designed and executed gold pin, assuming, as Frink had pointed out, that their stuff went over at all. At this point, they had not yet tried to sell. They had solved what seemed to be their basic technical problems. They had their bench with motors, flex cable machine, arbor of grinding and polishing wheels. They had, in fact, a complete range of finishing tools, ranging from the coarse wire brushes through brass brushes and Cratex wheels to finer polishing buffs of cotton, linen, leather, chamois, which could be coated with compounds ranging from emery and pumice to the most delicate rouges. And of course they had their oxyacetylene welding outfit, their tanks, gauges, hoses, tips, masks, and superb jeweler's tools. Pliers from Germany and France, micrometers, diamond drills, saws, tongs, tweezers, third-hand structures for soldering, vices, polishing cloths, shears, hand-forged tiny hammers, rows of precision equipment. And their supplies of brazing rod of various gauge, sheet metal, pinbacks, links, earring clipbacks. Well over half the $2,000 had been spent. They had in their Ed Frank bank account only $250 now, but they were set up legally. They even had their PSA permits. Nothing remained but to sell. No retailer, Frink thought as he studied the displays, can give these a tougher inspection than we have. They certainly looked good, these few select pieces, each painstakingly gone over for bad welds, rough or sharp edges, spots of fire color. Their quality control was excellent. The slightest dullness or wire brush scratch had been enough reason to return a piece to the shop. We can't afford to show any crude or unfinished work. One unnoticed black speck on a silver necklace, and we're finished. On their list, Robert Childan's store appeared first. But only Ed could go there. Childan would certainly remember Frank Frink.
You got to do most of the actual selling, Ed said.
But he was resigned to approaching Childan himself. He had bought a good suit, new tie, white shirt, to make the right impression. Nonetheless, he looked ill at ease.
I know we're good, he said for the millionth time, but hell.
Most of the pieces were abstract, whirls of wire, loops, designs which to some extent the molten metals had taken on their own. Some had a spider-web delicacy, an airiness.
others had a massive, powerful, almost barbaric heaviness. There was an amazing range of shape, considering how few pieces lay on the velvet trays, and yet one store, Frink realized, could buy everything we have laid out here. We'll see each store once, if we fail. But if we succeed, if we get them to carry our line, we'll be going back to refill orders the rest of our lives. Together, the two of them loaded the velvet board trays into the wicker basket. We could get back something on the metal, Frink said to himself, if worse comes to worst, and the tools and equipment. We can dispose of them at a loss, but at least we'll get something. This is the moment to consult the Oracle. Ask, how will Ed make out on this first selling trip? But he was too nervous to. It might give a bad omen, and he did not feel capable of facing it. In any case, the die was cast, the pieces were made, the shop set up. Whatever the I Ching might blab out at this point. It can't sell our jewelry for us. It can't give us luck. I'll tackle Childan's place first, Ed said. We might as well get it over with. And then you can try a couple. You're coming along, aren't you? In the truck. I'll park around the corner. As they got into their pickup truck with their wicker hamper, Frink thought, God knows how good a salesman Ed is, or I am. Childan can be sold, but it's going to take a presentation, like they say. If Juliana were here, he thought, she could stroll in there and do it without batting an eye. She's pretty, she can talk to anybody on earth, and she's a woman. After all, this is women's jewelry. She could wear it into the store. Shutting his eyes, he tried to imagine how she would look with one of their bracelets on, or one of their large silver necklaces, with her black hair and her pale skin, doleful, probing eyes, wearing a gray jersey sweater a little bit too tight, the silver resting against her bare flesh, metal rising and falling as she breathed. God, she was vivid in his mind right now. Every piece they made, the strong, thin fingers picked up, examined, tossing her head back, holding the piece high. Juliana sorting, always a witness to what he had done. Best for her, he decided, would be earrings. The bright, dangly ones, especially the brass. With her hair held back by a clip, or cut short so that her neck and ears could be seen. And we could take photos of her for advertising and display. He and Ed had discussed a catalog so they could sell by mail to stores in other parts of the world. She would look terrific. Her skin is nice, very healthy, no sagging or wrinkles, and a fine color. Would she do it if I could locate her? No matter what she thinks of me, nothing to do with our personal life, this would be a strictly business matter. Hell, I wouldn't even take the pictures. We'd get a professional photographer to do it. That would please her. Her vanity probably as great as always. She always liked people to look at her, admire her, anybody. I guess most women are like that. They crave attention all the time. They're very babyish that way. He thought, Juliana could never stand being alone. She had to have me around all the time complimenting her. Little kids are that way. They feel if their parents aren't watching what they do, then what they do isn't real. No doubt she's got some guy noticing her right now, telling her how pretty she is, her legs, her smooth, flat stomach. What's the matter? Ed said, glancing at him. Losing your nerve? No, Frink said. I'm not just going to stand there, Ed said. I've got a few ideas of my own, and I'll tell you something else. I'm not scared. I'm not intimidated just because it's a fancy place and I have to put on this fancy suit. I admit I don't like to dress up. I admit I'm not comfortable, but that doesn't matter a bit. I'm still going in there and really give it to that poophead. Good for you, Frink thought. Hell, if you could go in there like you did, Ed said, and give him that line about being a Jap admiral's gentleman, I ought to be able to tell him the truth, that this is really good, creative, original, handmade jewelry that... Hand-wrought. Frink said. Yeah, hand wrought. I mean, I'll go in there, and I won't come back out until I've given him a run for his money. He ought to buy this. If he doesn't, he's really nuts. I've looked around. There isn't anything like ours for sale anywhere. God, when I think of him maybe looking at it and not buying it, it makes me so goddamn mad I could start swinging.
Make sure you tell him it's not plated, Frank said. That copper means solid copper and brass, solid brass.
You let me work out my own approach, Ed said. I got some really good ideas.
Frank thought. What I can do is this. I can take a couple of pieces, Ed'll never care, and box them up and send them to Juliana so she'll see what I'm doing. The postal authorities will trace her. I'll send it registered to her last known address. What'll she say when she opens the box? There'll have to be a note from me explaining that I made it myself, that I'm a partner in a little new creative jewelry business. I'll fire her imagination, give her an account that'll make her want to know more, that'll get her interested. I'll talk about the gems and the metals, the places we're selling to, the fancy stores.
Isn't it along here? Ed said, slowing the truck.
They were in heavy downtown traffic, buildings blotted out the sky.
I better park.
Another 5 blocks, Frank said.
Got one of those marijuana cigarettes?
Ed said. One would calm me right about now. Frank passed him his package of Tien Lies, the heavenly music brand he had learned to smoke at WM Corporation. I know she's living with some guy, Frank said to himself, sleeping with him. As if she was his wife. I know Juliana. She couldn't survive any other way. I know how she gets around nightfall, when it gets cold and dark and everybody's home sitting around the living room. She was never made for a solitary life. Me neither, he realized. Maybe the guy's a real nice guy. Some shy student she picked up. She'd be a good woman for some young guy who had never had the courage to approach a woman before. She's not hard or cynical. It would do him a lot of good. I hope to hell she's not with some older guy. That's what I couldn't stand. Some experienced, mean guy with a toothpick sticking out of the side of his mouth, pushing her around. He felt himself begin to breathe heavily. Image of some beefy, hairy guy stepping down hard on Juliana, making her life miserable. I know she'd finally wind up killing herself, he thought. It's in the cards for her if she doesn't find the right man, and that means a really gentle, sensitive, kindly student type who would be able to appreciate all those thoughts she has. I was too rough for her, he thought. And I'm not so bad. There are a hell of a lot of guys worse than me. I could pretty well figure out what she was thinking, what she wanted, when she felt lonely or bad or depressed. I spent a lot of time worrying and fussing over her, but it wasn't enough. She deserved more. She deserves a lot, he thought.
I'm parking, Ed said.
He had found a place and was backing the truck, peering over his shoulder. Listen, Frank said, can I send a couple of pieces to my wife?
I didn't know you were married.
Intent on parking, Ed answered him reflexively.
Sure, as long as they're not silver.
Ed shut off the truck motor.
We're here, he said.
He puffed marijuana smoke, then stubbed the cigarette out on the dashboard, dropped the remains to the cab floor.
Wish me luck.
Luck, Frank said.
Hey, look. There's one of those Jap Waka poems on the back of this cigarette package.
Ed read the poem aloud over the traffic noises.
Hearing a cuckoo cry, I looked up in the direction whence the sound came. What did I see? Only the pale moon in the dawning sky.
He handed the package of Tien Lies back to Frank.
Christ, he said, then slapped Frank on the back, grinned, opened the truck door, picked up the wicker hamper, and stepped from the truck. I'll let you put the dime in the meter, he said, starting off down the sidewalk.
In an instant, he had disappeared among the other pedestrians.
Juliana, Frank thought, are you as alone as I am?
He got out of the truck and put a dime in the parking meter. Fear, he thought. This whole jewelry venture, what if it should fail? What if it should fail?
That was how the oracle put it. Wailing, tears, beating the pot. Man faces the darkening shadows of his life, his passage to the grave. If she were here, it wouldn't be so bad. Not bad at all. I'm scared, he realized. Suppose Ed doesn't sell a thing. Suppose they laugh at us. What then? On a sheet on the floor of the front room of her apartment, Juliana lay holding Joe Cinadella against her. The room was warm and stuffy with mid-afternoon sunlight. Her body and the body of the man in her arms were damp with perspiration. A drop, rolling down Joe's forehead, clung a moment to his cheekbone, then fell to her throat. "You're still dripping," she murmured. He said nothing. His breathing, long, slow, regular, like the ocean, she thought. We're nothing but water inside. "How was it?" she asked. He mumbled that it had been okay. "I thought so," Juliana thought. "I can tell. Now we both have to get up, pull ourselves together. Or is that bad? Sign of subconscious disapproval?" He stirred. "Are you getting up?" She gripped him tight with both her arms. "Don't, not yet."
"Don't you have to get to the gym?"
"I'm not going to the gym," Juliana said to herself. "Don't you know that? We will go somewhere. We won't stay here too much longer, but it will be a place we haven't been before. It's time." She felt him start to draw himself backward and up onto his knees. Felt her hands slide along his damp, slippery back. Then she could hear him walking away, his bare feet against the floor, to the bathroom, no doubt, for his shower. "It's over," she thought. "Oh, well," she sighed.
"I hear you," Joe said from the bathroom. "Groaning, always downcast, aren't you? Worry, fear, and suspicion about me and everything else in the world."
He emerged briefly, dripping with soapy water, face beaming.
"How would you like to take a trip?"
Her pulse quickened. "Where?"
"To some big city. How about north to Denver? I'll take you out, buy you ticket to a show, good restaurant, taxi, get you evening dress or what you need, okay?"
She could hardly believe him, but she wanted to. She tried to.
"Will that steward of yours make it?" Joe called.
"Sure," she said.
"We'll both get some nice clothes," he said. "Enjoy ourselves, maybe for the first time in our lives. Keep you from cracking up."
"Where'll we get the money?"
Joe said. "I have it. Look in my suitcase."
He shut the bathroom door. The racket of water shut out any further words. Opening the dresser, she got out his dented, stained little grip. Sure enough, in one corner she found an envelope. It contained Reichsbank bills, high value and good anywhere. "Then we can go," she realized. "Maybe he's not just stringing me along. I just wish I could get inside him and see what's there," she thought as she counted the money. Beneath the envelope she found a huge, cylindrical fountain pen, or at least it appeared to be that. It had a clip, anyhow. But it weighed so much. Gingerly she lifted it out, unscrewed the cap. Yes, it had a gold point, but... "What is this?" she asked Joe when he reappeared from the shower. He took it from her, returned it to the grip. How carefully he handled it. She noticed that, reflected on it, perplexed.
"More morbidity," Joe said.
He seemed light-hearted, more so than at any time since she had met him. With a yell of enthusiasm, he clasped her around the waist, then hoisted her up into his arms, rocking her, swinging her back and forth, peering down into her face, breathing his warm breath over her, squeezing her until she bleated.
"No," she said, "I'm just slow to change."
"Still a little scared of you," she thought. "So scared I can't even say it. Tell you about it."
"Out the window," Joe cried, stalking across the room with her in his arms. "Here we go." "Please," she said. "Kidding. Listen,
We're going on a march, like the march on Rome. You remember that? The Duce led them, my Uncle Carlo, for example. Now we have a little march, less important, not noted in the history books. Right?
Inclining his head, he kissed her on the mouth so hard that their teeth clashed.
How nice we both look in our new clothes. And you can explain to me exactly how to talk, deport myself, right? Teach me manners, right?
You talk okay, Juliana said. Better than me, even.
No.
He became abruptly somber.
I talked very bad. A real whopper accent. Didn't you notice it when you first met me in the cafe?
I guess so, she said. It did not seem important to her.
Only a woman knows the social conventions, Joe said, carrying her back and dropping her to bounce frighteningly on the bed. Without a woman, we'd discuss racing cars into horses and tell dirty jokes. No civilization.
You're in a strange mood, Juliana thought. Restless and brooding until you decide to move on, then you become hopped up. Do you really want me? You can ditch me, leave me here. It's happened before.
I would ditch you, she thought, if I were going on.
Is that your pay? She asked as he dressed. You saved it up? It was so much. Of course, there was a good deal of money in the East.
All the other truck drivers I've talked to never made so... You say I'm a truck driver?
Joe broke in.
Listen, I rode that rig not to drive, but keep off hijackers. Look like a truck driver snoozing in the cab.
Flopping in a chair in the corner of the room, he lay back, pretending sleep, his mouth open, body limp.
See?
At first, she did not see. And then she realized that in his hand was a knife, as thin as a kitchen potato skewer.
Good grief, she thought. Where had it come from?
Out of his sleeve. Out of the air itself.
That's why the Volkswagen people hired me. Service record. We protected ourselves against Hazelden, those commandos. He led them.
The black eyes glinted. He grinned sideways at Juliana.
Guess who got the colonel there at the end? When we caught them on the Nile, him and four of his long-range desert group, months after the Cairo campaign, they raided us for gasoline one night. I was on sentry duty. Hazelden sneaked up, rubbed with black all over his face and body, even his hands. They had no wire that time, only grenades and submachine guns. All too noisy. He tried to break my larynx. I got him.
From the chair, Joe sprang up at her, laughing.
Let's pack. You tell them at the gym you're taking a few days off. Phone them.
His account simply did not convince her. Perhaps he had not been in North Africa at all, had not even fought in the war on the Axis side, had not even fought. What hijackers, she wondered. No truck that she knew of had come through Cannon City from the East Coast with an armed professional ex-soldier as guard. Maybe he had not even lived in the USA, had made everything up from the start, a line to snare her, to get her interested, to appear romantic. Maybe he's insane, she thought. Ironic. I may actually do what I've pretended many times to have done, use my judo in self-defense to save my virginity? My life, she thought. But more likely, he is just some poor, low-class, wop-laboring slob with delusions of glory. He wants to go on a grand spree, spend all his money, live it up, and then go back to his monotonous existence. And he needs a girl to do it.
Okay, she said. I'll call the gym.
As she went toward the hall, she thought, he'll buy me expensive clothes and then take me to some luxurious hotel. Every man yearns to have a really well-dressed woman before he dies, even if he has to buy her the clothes himself. This binge is probably Joe Sinadella's lifelong ambition, and he is shrewd. I'll bet he's right in his analysis of me. I have a neurotic fear of the masculine. Frank knew it, too. That's why he and I broke up. That's why I still feel this anxiety now, this mistrust.
When she returned from the payphone, she found Joe once more engrossed in the grasshopper, scowling as he read, unaware of everything else. "Weren't you going to let me read that?" she asked. "Maybe while I drive," Joe said, without looking up. "You're going to drive? But it's my car." He said nothing. He merely went on reading. At the cash register, Robert Childan looked up to see a lean, tall, dark-haired man entering the store. The man wore a slightly less than fashionable suit and carried a large wicker hamper. Salesman. Yet he did not have the cheerful smile. Instead, he had a grim, morose look on his leathery face, more like a plumber or an electrician, Robert Childan thought. When he had finished with his customer, Childan called to the man, "Who do you represent?"
"Ed Frank Jewelry," the man mumbled back.
He had set his hamper down on one of the counters. "Never heard of them." Childan sauntered over as the man unfastened the top of the hamper and with much wasted motion opened it.
"Hand-wrought, each unique, each an original. Brass, copper, silver, even hot-forged black iron."
Childan glanced into the hamper. Metal on black velvet. Peculiar.
"No thanks, not in my line." "This represents American artistry, contemporary."
Shaking his head no, Childan walked back to the cash register. For a time, the man stood fooling with his velvet display boards and hamper. He was neither taking the boards out nor putting them back. He seemed to have no idea what he was doing. His arms folded. Childan watched, thinking about various problems of the day. At 2, he had an appointment to show some early period cups. Then at 3, another batch of items returning from the Cal labs, home from their authenticity test. He had been having more and more pieces examined in the last couple of weeks, ever since the nasty incident with the Colt 44.
"These are not plated,"
the man with the wicker hamper said, holding up a cuff bracelet.
"Solid copper."
Childan nodded without answering. The man would hang around for a while, shuffle his samples about, but finally he would move on. The telephone rang. Childan answered it. Customer, inquiring about an ancient rocking chair, very valuable, which Childan was having mended for him. It had not been finished, and Childan had to tell a convincing story. Staring through the store window at the midday traffic, he soothed and reassured. At last, the customer, somewhat appeased, rang off. No doubt about it, he thought as he hung up the phone, the Colt 44 affair had shaken him considerably. He no longer viewed his stock with the same reverence. Bit of knowledge like that goes a long way. Akin to primal childhood awakening, facts of life. Shows, he ruminated, the link with our early years, not merely U.S. history involved, but our own personal. As if, he thought, question might arise as to authenticity of our birth certificate, or our impression of Dad. Maybe I don't actually recall FDR as example. Synthetic image distilled from hearing assorted talk. Myth implanted subtly in tissue of brain. Like, he thought, myth of Heppelwhite, myth of Chippendale. Or rather more on lines of Abraham Lincoln ate here, used this old silver knife, fork, spoon. You can't see it, but the fact remains. At the other counter, still fumbling with his displays and wicker hamper, the salesman said,
"We can make pieces to order, custom-made, if any of your customers have their own ideas."
His voice had a strangled quality. He cleared his throat, gazing at Childan and then down at a piece of jewelry which he held. He did not know how to leave, evidently. Childan smiled and said nothing. "Not my responsibility. His, to get himself back out of here. Place saved or no." Tough, such discomfort. "But he doesn't have to be salesman. We all suffer in this life. Look at me, taking it all day from Japs such as Mr. Tagomi. By merest inflection, managed to rub my nose in it, make my life miserable." And then, an idea occurred to him. Fellows obviously not experienced. Look at him.
maybe I can get some stuff on consignment. Worth a try.
Hey, Childan said. The man glanced up swiftly, fastened his gaze. Advancing toward him, his arms still folded, Childan said,
Looks like a quiet half hour here. No promises, but you can lay some of those things out. Clear back those racks of ties, he pointed.
Nodding, the man began to clear himself a space on the top of the counter. He reopened his hamper, once more fumbled with the velvet trays.
He'll lay everything out, Childan knew. Arrange it painstakingly for the next hour. Fuss and adjust until he's got it all set up, hoping, praying, watching me out of the corner of his eye every second, to see if I'm taking any interest, any at all.
When you have it out, Childan said, if I'm not too busy, I'll take a look.
The man worked feverishly as if he had been stung.
Several customers entered the store then, and Childan greeted them. He turned his attention to them and their wishes, and forgot the salesman laboring over his display. The salesman, recognizing the situation, became stealthy in his movements. He made himself inconspicuous. Childan sold a shaving mug, almost sold a hand-hooked rug, took a deposit on an afghan. Time passed. At last the customers left. Once more, the store was empty, except for himself and the salesman. The salesman had finished. His entire selection of jewelry lay arranged on the black velvet on the surface of the counter. Going leisurely over, Robert Childan lit a land of smiles and stood rocking back and forth on his heels, humming beneath his breath. The salesman stood silently. Neither spoke. At last, Childan reached out and pointed at a pin.
I like that.
The salesman said in a rapid voice, That's a good one. You won't find any wire brush scratches. All rouge finished, and it won't tarnish. We have a plastic lacquer sprayed on them that'll last for years. It's the best industrial lacquer available.
Childan nodded slightly.
What we've done here, the salesman said, is to adapt tried and proven industrial techniques to jewelry making. As far as I know, nobody's ever done it before. No molds. All metal to metal, welding and brazing. He paused. The backs are hand-soldered.
Childan picked up two bracelets, then a pin, then another pin. He held them for a moment, then set them off to one side. The salesman's face twitched. Hope.
Examining the price tag on a necklace, Childan said, Is this retail? Your price is 50% of that, and if you buy, say, around $100 or so, we give you an additional 2%.
One by one, Childan laid several pieces aside. With each additional one, the salesman became more agitated. He talked faster and faster, finally repeating himself, even saying meaningless, foolish things, all in an undertone and very urgently.
He really thinks he's going to sell, Childan knew. By his own expression, he showed nothing.
He went on with the game of picking pieces.
That's an especially good one. The salesman was rambling on as Childan fished out a large pendant and then ceased. I think you got our best, all our best.
The man laughed.
You really have good taste.
His eyes darted. He was adding in his mind what Childan had chosen, the total of the sale. Childan said, Our policy with untried merchandise has to be consignment. For a few seconds, the salesman did not understand. He stopped his talking, but he stared without comprehension.
Childan smiled at him. Consignment,
the salesman echoed at last. Would you prefer not to leave it? Childan said.
Stammering, the man finally said, You mean I leave it and you pay me later on when...
You get 2/3 of the proceeds when the pieces sell. That way you make much more. You have to wait, of course, but... Childan shrugged. It's up to you. I can give it some window display, possibly. And if it moves, then possibly later on, in a month or so, with the next order, well, we might see our way clear to buy some outright.
The salesman had now spent well over an hour showing his wares, Childan realized. And he had everything out.
all his displays disarranged and dismantled. Another hour's work to get it back ready to take somewhere else. There was silence. Neither man spoke.
"Those pieces you put to one side," the salesman said in a low voice, "they're the ones you want?"
"Yes, I'll let you leave them all." Chuldan strolled over to his office in the rear of the store. "I'll write up a tag so you'll have a record of what you've left with me." As he came back with his tag book, he added, "You understand that when merchandise is left on a consignment basis, the store doesn't assume liability in case of theft or damage." He had a little mimeographed release for the salesman to sign. The store would never have to account for the items left. When the unsold portion was returned, if some could not be located, they must have been stolen, Chuldan declared to himself. There's always theft going on in stores, especially small items like jewelry. There was no way that Robert Chuldan could lose. He did not have to pay for this man's jewelry. He had no investment in this kind of inventory. If any of it sold, he made a profit, and if it did not, he simply returned it all, or as much as could be found, to the salesman at some vague later date. Chuldan made out the tag, listing the items. He signed it and gave a copy to the salesman. "You can give me a call," he said, "in a month or so to find out how it's been doing." Taking the jewelry which he wanted, he went off to the back of the store, leaving the salesman to gather up his remaining stuff. "I didn't think he'd go along with it," he thought. "You never know. That's why it's always worth trying." When he next looked up, he saw that the salesman was ready to leave. He had his wicker hamper under his arm, and the counter was clear. The salesman was coming toward him, holding something out. "Yes?" Chuldan said. He had been going over some correspondence.
"I want to leave our card."
The salesman put down an odd-looking little square of gray and red paper on Chuldan's desk.
"Ed Frank Custom Jewelry. It has our address and phone number, in case you want to get in touch with us."
Chuldan nodded, smiled silently, and returned to his work. When next he paused and looked up, the store was empty. The salesman had gone. Putting a nickel into the wall dispenser, Chuldan obtained a cup of hot instant tea, which he sipped contemplatively. "I wonder if it will sell," he wondered. "Very unlikely. But it is well made, and one never sees anything like it." He examined one of the pins. "Quite striking design. Certainly not amateurs. I'll change the tags, mark them up a lot higher, push the handmade angle, and the uniqueness. Custom originals, small sculptures, wear a work of art. Exclusive creation on your lapel or wrist." And there was another notion circulating and growing in the back of Robert Chuldan's mind. With these, there's no problem of authenticity. And that problem may someday wreck the historic American artifacts industry. Not today or tomorrow, but after that, who knows? Better not to have all irons in one fire. That visit by that Jewish crook, that might be the harbinger. If I quietly build up a stock of non-historic objects, contemporary work with no historicity, either real or imagined, I might find I have the edge over the competition. And as long as it isn't costing me anything. Leaning back his chair so that it rested against the wall, he sipped his tea and pondered. The moment changes. One must be ready to change with it, or otherwise left high and dry. Adapt. The rule of survival, he thought. Keep eye peeled regarding situation around you. Learn its demands, and meet them. Be there at the right time, doing the right thing. Be yinnish. The Oriental knows. The smart black yinnish eyes. Suddenly, he had a good idea. It made him sit upright instantly. Two birds, one stone. Ah!
He hopped to his feet, excited, carefully wrap best of jewelry pieces, removing tag, of course. Pin, pendant, or bracelet. Something nice, anyhow. Then, since have to leave shop, close up at 2 as it is, saunter over to Kasura's apartment building. Mr. Kasura, Paul, will be at work. However, Mrs. Kasura, Betty, will very likely be home. Graft gift. This new original U.S. artwork. Compliments of myself personally in order to obtain high place reaction. This is how a new line is introduced. Isn't it lovely? Whole selection back at store. Drop in, etc. This one for you, Betty. He trembled. Just she and I. Midday in the apartment. Husband off at work. All on up and up, however. Brilliant pretext. Airtight. Getting a small box plus wrapping paper and ribbon, Robert Childan began preparing a gift for Mrs. Kasura. Dark, attractive woman, slender in her silk oriental dress, high heels, and so on. Or maybe today, blue, cotton, coolie-style lounging pajamas, very light and comfortable and informal. Ah, he thought. Or is this too bold? Husband Paul becoming irked. Scenting out and reacting badly. Perhaps go slower, take gift to him. To his office? Give much the same story, but to him. Then let him give gift to her. No suspicion. And, Robert Childan thought, then I give Betty a call on the phone tomorrow or next day to get her reaction. Even more airtight. When Frank Frink saw his business partner coming back up the sidewalk, he could tell that it had not gone well. What happened? He said, taking the wicker hamper from Ed and putting it in the truck. Jesus Christ, you were gone an hour and a half. It took him that long to say no? Ed said, he didn't say no. He looked tired. He got into the truck and sat. What did he say then? Opening the hamper, Frink saw that a good many of the pieces were gone, many of their best. He took a lot. What's the matter then? Consignment, Ed said. You let him? He could not believe it. We talked it over. I don't know how come. Christ, Frink said. I'm sorry. He acted like he was going to buy it. He picked a lot out. I thought he was buying. They sat together silently in the truck. For a long time.
This ends side 2 of cassette 4 of The Man in the High Castle. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 5.